Any other questions on 383? And Sam, you can let us know when you're ready to respond to the other issue on 383. In the meantime, hearing no other questions on this one, we'll circle back to get a response on some other issues there. But let's move on to number 384, which is paired, and we've already referenced it. And that's the pain intensity quantified. And for that one, I have Dr. Pfister.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the prior discussion is actually quite relevant to this. And I guess that looking to be efficient, I think some of the issues that Jennifer brought up, I don't think are worth revisiting, because I think some of the same principles apply. But but circling back to the question I just asked, that in terms of the that they just didn't do it, but rather that it was kind of quantified, it was unclear to me about the issue of harmonization among the the way that this would be quantitated. I think that you need to have a starting point somewhere in this business, and so I fully am sympathetic that there needs to be a start. But I think if you have that with the focus of this measure being sort of different from the prior one having to do with the intensity, that seems to be sort of a fundamental issue that further kind of leverages into some of the comments that Jennifer made. I think that, I think it has, pain and trying to do a better job with pain control in a cancer population certainly has, face validity to it. And I do think that that as far as reporting data publicly, that I think that it would have something that would be of great interest. Although, I guess I would be less optimistic about its ability as a quality improvement measure. And I think those were my my main thoughts.
And that, again, is that based on you're looking at the evidence, the reliability and validity of the measure?
Mm-hmm. Because I think that some of the same issues with, I think, the reliability and validity, I went through 383 and 384 since they're kind of paired. A lot of that text looked virtually identical between both submissions. And so I think that, and these two measures are quite related. So I'm not sure that the data provided for 384 is any more robust than the data for 383. It's heavily guideline kind of derived. The issues with the evidence in terms of the grading and assessment, again, is sort of in the one set of guidelines. It's kind of a consensus-based grading system. I think in the pain guideline, I'm not sure there was a formal rating system. So there's kind of very heavy consensus that this is sort of an important thing to do, which I think permeates much of this measure the same way it did for 383.
Other discussion from the committee?
This is Brian Loy, and I'm just, as I'm listening to the dialogue develop, I'm wondering if the measure developers or the author of these sections that span both of these measures, if those authors are in a position to further characterize this kind of broad body of evidence with a finer point to answer some of the questions that are being raised. I mean, it feels like I noticed the same thing. We've got, virtually identical text. We've got some general references, but in terms of an actual evidence assessment, I'm finding myself agreeing with the presenters in that I still at best feel like it's unknown as to whether or not they really meet the criteria that we have in front of us.
That's right, yeah. I think as reviewers, we're held to a pretty high standard in terms of what counts as evidence that it should be specific to this measure for a maintenance measure. And so when we're not presented with the evidence here, it makes it very hard to evaluate.
Could someone representing the measure speak to that?
Yeah, hi, this is Sam Tierney again. I apologize if some of you are on the hematology calls because this will be repetitive, but I think it's helpful to at least share with you our overall methodology for developing performance measures. We have always based our measures on clinical practice guidelines, and so in answering these questions, we refer to those clinical practice guideline statements that are specific to the measure. I can appreciate that as NQF added these new criteria related to the quantity, quality, and consistency of the evidence, different guideline developers assess that in different ways and share that information in different ways. And unfortunately, the NCCN guidelines have quite a bit of text to add to their algorithms, which are the kind of the primary source of their recommendations. But generally, they don't provide information related to the quantity, quality, or consistency of evidence apart from their overall rating scale. And I do know that just in previous direction we've received from NQF, that I know that NQF has said that they don't expect measure developers to conduct primary evidence reviews, but rather to use existing systematic reviews and grading of evidence that have been done by others. So we are limited by what's available. I will say that I know the Cochrane Collaboration has done a number of reviews on the treatment of cancer pain, but that is specific to different treatment modalities, and these measures are quite broad. You know, the plan of care for pain, for example, would include any number of those elements, but it's just a very broad plan of care for pain, which I think is supported by the guideline recommendations, but something like a systematic review of a plan of care for pain is not really available, and it would be specific to the actual treatment modality. So I just wanted to offer that and put that might offer some information to put the review, the information in the submission forms into different contexts and share the struggles and challenges that we face in trying to complete those sections of the form.
I'm wondering, is it, and this is a question that I would ask with you, being new to this process, I think one of the issues that I struggled with in reviewing both of these measures is that the document actually points out to us that the categorization arrived at by the NCCN was a 2A, that there was, although there was uniform consensus, but they conceded that this was based on lower level evidence. And that seemed to, you know, kind of define what our level of evidence rating was without additional information. So I'm just wondering, you know, if we were asked to defend our position, if there might be within this body of evidence, knowing that it gets updated periodically with new literature, I don't know if there's more recent literature that hasn't been cited in the guideline or in an updated iteration of the NCCN guideline that we're not seeing here. So that's a question. And to distill that down, is there more current evidence that would take that to a place where we would no longer be kind of obliged to adhere to the Category 2A recognition that NCCN has assigned to this?
This is Sam Tierney. Sorry, I'm not sure if that was a question for me or for NQF staff, but I just thought I'd also mention, and I'm sure Angela and NQF colleagues are quite familiar with this, but I know the evidence report that NQF puts out does have some sort of explanation about what to do in instances where there isn't strong evidence of certainty of net benefit, and that those decisions could be based on expert judgment, that the benefits would clearly outweigh the harm. So I know there are some kind of unique scenarios when the evidence is lacking, and I think this report specifically says, recognizing that much of healthcare has not been subjected to research studies, and therefore there wouldn't be a strong evidence base to support the measures.
That is correct, Sam, as you stated it, for NQF. Is that the question, I think, Dave, you were asking, or were you looking for guidance in terms of how to grade the lower level evidence?
Yeah, this is Brian Loy. I was the one that asked the question. I'm feeling obliged to call this, you know, the grade as a lower level evidence, because that's really all I have to go on. I mean, as already been stated before, I feel like I'm basically looking at a generalization of a very broad body of evidence, and it looks to me that the NCCN concluded that this was not really an evidence-based decision as much as it was a consensus-based decision. So, yeah, I think the guidance that was just given to me in response to that was that if there is more good than harm, or if there's less harm, I'm not sure, I'm probably ruining that, that we might be given some different guidance, but I'm not sure what that allows us to consider.
Okay. So, other than so other than restating that, if you feel like on the face of the measure, this is an area where there isn't any additional stronger evidence to support the measure, and it's still the benefit of the measure outweighs the harm of not having that evidence available, then you could still vote in support of the measure.
So when we get, so for example, I mean, it seems like based on the criteria, when it's on, it's based on a clinical practice guideline that does not provide information on quantity, quality, and consistency, and we're sort of forced to say that there's insufficient evidence to evaluate that. And so it seems like we then have sort of stopping guidelines in our, you know, in our rubrics for evaluating these. But you're saying we could move on to that and say that in the big picture, despite having this evidence, we could
move forward. And then we also rely on the committee members. If they're aware of there's more evidence out there than what's included in the form or that's in the guideline, or if there's newer evidence that would strengthen the measure that they're aware of, we also rely on the committee to let us know that information as well.
Okay.
We'll also be able to discuss this at the in-person meeting.
That's great.
So any other questions about 384 or discussion? Looking at both of them, there were some questions that we had that AMA-PCPI was going to address on 383. Are they ready to discuss those? Since this is a pair. Other ones.
You know, thank you, Angela. We're still in the process of gathering that information, and honestly, we're missing a staff person who might be able to help enlighten the discussion. So I don't know if we'll be able to provide that on the phone today. Is that something we could try to get back to you in writing after the fact?
Yes, that would work.
Yeah, you can send it to us, and we'll disseminate it to the committee members.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
So on these two measures, 384 and 383, do we have an initial recommendation from the committee? On 383 and 384? No?
I'm going to propose, it sounds like that we still have some contingencies, and I don't know if we can defer that judgment until the in-person meeting or they supply the additional information.
Yes.
Is that an option?
Yes, that's an option. You can recommend, with the contingency that you'd like to see something additional or an additional response from the developer.
Yeah, I certainly was more sympathetic to both measures until I heard this discussion. So I think that there are things which I would have before said were adequate, that now I would say there's insufficient data to address at the present time. And so I think I would endorse that, you know, proceeding in that manner.
Okay. Any other comments about the recommendations on 383 and 384? Okay. All right, moving on, we have measure number 386, cancer stage documented, also an AMA PCPI measure. And we had asked Dr. Pfister to talk about this measure or start us off with the discussion of this measure, if he's able to do that.
Well, you know, I found out that was going to be my role about 15 minutes ago, but I'll make the best of it under the circumstances. The you know, certainly there's no argument that knowing what a stage is a fundamental aspect for planning treatment. I think also there is ample data provided that that stage is associated with prognosis. I think that's clear. I think, and so I think that, you know, in that regard, those are both, you know, positives in that regard. I think in terms of the actual data provided to show that by so while knowing the stage allows you to predict prognosis, whether the connection between that we actually document that in the note and it translated to improved outcome, I don't feel that there's data presented to sort of document that aspect of what the measure is intended to do in terms of quality improvement. Also, I was a little confused because, someone made the comment about focusing on breast and colorectal. It's such a fundamental thing you'd expect that we could expand this to other things. But, you know, I was okay with the focus on these two big public health issues. But one of the things that was a little confusing to me was that for breast, it seems to be based on clinical stage. And then if pathologic information is available, then you would further sort of modify the staging information to incorporate pathologic data. But that for colorectal, it seemed to be pretty much based on sort of pathologic staging. And I guess that for the breast component, in terms of defining the stage, and that I would think that you know that this kind of, well, if it's available, I guess I needed more reassurance that there wouldn't be confusion in the transition of the flow of information from clinical to pathologic. And then within the realm of the pathologic staging, I was a little concerned that, you know, they say, well, it's for people who have non-metastatic cancer, I guess, with the implication, well, that would make you stage four and that would change the playing field. But that, you know, there are people that, let's say, might have non-metastatic cancer, but that would not be surgical candidates that we would never, that you wouldn't be able to go to the operating room, so you would have incomplete pathologic staging. But when you look at sort of their description of the denominator exclusions, it looked like there were none. And so I thought that scenario would be something that would not be addressed. I thought that, you know, as I said, I think that as far as public reporting goes and public interest, I'm not sure how high that would be. I think that the, you know, I think the data for the harms of including that in the note, I think, are basically the data to show that there's no harm is kind of insufficient, because let's say that you have inclusion of a stage, which I was actually a little surprised to see that it seemed that the data provide for reliability or you know, inner observer rating seem to be as high as it is, because my own personal experience is actually these the TNM staging can vary quite a bit among observers, and that you know, sometimes you have something placed in the chart that may have a certain kind of sacrosanct status that may be perpetuated even though it happens to be the wrong stage. So I think that, again, I think that the strength is that I think clearly it's important for treatment planning. I think it's a low bar for that. I think clearly stages relate to prognosis. But some of the other NQF criteria that are sort of listed are the measure had more tough sledding with.
Are there other comments from the other work group members?
Yeah, this is Brian Loy. I echo the presenter's comments on perpetuating misstaging information. And I believe that, you know, there may be an issue about some of those guidelines or stagings that are either in controversy or in a refinement period or perhaps still in development. My other comment might be, as I was reviewing the measure and I noticed the data source being administrative claims, it wasn't clear to me how anyone could ascertain much of anything about staging from administrative claims, because I've yet to see an ICD-9 code that informs stage. So that was my concern.
So just to... go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Steve is maybe muting his phone or driving or something, but, you know, he brought up, Brian, that same concern about, you know, at least in terms of the electronic capture of this information and the limitations that, you know, involved there.
So the clarification, I guess, that I wanted to point out is that it seems like, you know, the ultimate question is whether this measure captures or represents quality. And it seems like, so what's happening in this case is it doesn't matter what stage is documented. As long as some stage has been documented, this then represents a measure of quality. And I don't think we've been presented with evidence that suggests that this code is accurately associated with quality, or that there's evidence that it represents quality. And maybe part of that is, you know, it's shown also that there was very little variability in performance on this. So, you know, the average was 96.9 or something like that, with very low variability. And that's probably because the bar is pretty low. It's just that the stage is documented, not that the correct stage is documented.
Do we have a response from the developer on that?
This is Sam Tierney. I'll just make a few comments, but I also know that our clinical expert, Dr. Heyman, has joined us. So then maybe after I make my comments, you can open up the line for him in case he has anything he'd like to add. I just wanted to clarify, I think there may be some confusion between the information that we provided in the guidelines, which is anything that's relevant to documenting stage, and the actual requirement of the measure, which is something you could find in the numerator statement. So the measure requires that patients would have a baseline AJCC cancer stage or documentation that the cancer is metastatic in the medical record. I know one of the physicians, I'm sorry, I don't recall your name, mentioned a concern about no exceptions, but I think that the case you described was for a patient whose cancer was metastatic, so that would count as meeting this measure. So I think that's why there have been no exceptions noted.
But I think for a pathologic stage that you need sort of pathologic material to stage someone in that manner. Like a clinical stage you could do without the pathologic material, but it seems at least for the colorectal, you're quite explicit about it being a pathologic stage. So I gave you the benefit of the doubt that for metastatic disease, you just say metastatic disease. But there are reasons people don't get complete pathologic staging information beyond having distant metastasis. Like, let's say you have a medical comorbidity that you don't, that they feel that they can't really, you know, do surgery on you, for example.
Okay, well, thank you for that additional feedback. We could look back at the NCCN guidelines. I think you might be focusing on this section where we're quoting verbatim the guidelines, and I'm not sure if looking at the numerator of the measure might alleviate your concerns at all. Is in 2A1.1, because just to clarify, that's the requirement of the measure, and the guidelines are just things that are supposed to help substantiate the reason for the measure. If I could also just comment on, someone commented on the performance gap data, and so we have data from a number of programs on this measure. We have data from the COPE measure, which is an adaptation of this measure. While the average performance rate is, fairly high at 83%, the range is from 35 to 100%. And we have data from Astro's Parrot program, which has an average performance of 87% and a range of 10 to 100%. There was also a study that was done fairly recently looking at documentation of colorectal cancer care provided by academic and community sites in the United States, which might be even considered to be more representative than those other programs, which are voluntary and for folks that are focused on quality improvement. And that actually found that only 38% of the eligible medical records reported TNM stage. So I think there's quite a bit of variability provided from the gap information. But I'll stop there and see if Dr. Heyman or anyone else on the phone would like to add any other comments from our measure developer group.
And Dr. Heyman, your line is open.
Thanks. This is Jim Heyman. I think that the intent, to be honest, the document is quite lengthy, so I don't want to misspeak here, but I think the intent is to report the best available stage, as would be the case in for say a tumor registry. So sometimes that's going to be the clinical stage, sometimes that's going to be the pathologic stage. But I think all of the practicing oncologists who are on the phone would probably agree that the lack of reporting of the patient's stage is a sign of poor quality. Now, you can argue whether that's poor quality of documentation or, that's poor quality, leads to poor quality treatment. But, in my opinion, that represents a poor quality. And, I think that there is variability out there. I think that I'm fairly familiar with the COPE program. There is self-selection of, practices that participate in that program. So to look at that program and say, oh, they're at 96% and that's representative of what's going on in routine clinical practice, I don't really think that that's accurate. And so I think that some of the data that Sam just shared regarding the variability is probably, shouldn't be overlooked. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Mike Hassett. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I didn't know if I was on or not. I would also support Dr. Heyman's comments pretty universally. I think there is always going to be change in the fundamental aspects of staging, but having the best available data is what I think this measure is really trying to target. And in some cases that may be clinical, in some cases that may be pathologic, but I don't think the measure is I think it's relatively agnostic on the finer points. And I think increasingly we're finding, at least from an oncology perspective, that stage is as fundamental to treatment decision making as is the underlying cancer diagnosis. I think it would be hard to hold as a standard for this measure a link between stage documentation and improved outcomes, just given the inherent challenges of cancer medicine de novo. And I guess the other comment that I would make from a quality improvement perspective, as we move more from a paper to an electronic-based chart, I think the importance of stage documentation is only going to increase to the extent that it will contribute to clinical decision support and population-based analytics.
Okay. Thanks. Are there any more questions from the work group regarding this measure?
Yeah, I'm hearing, again, Brian Loy, new to this process, but clearly hearing what the commenters are saying. What I'm hearing is that that there is a two-piece argument here. One, that quality of documentation is desirable, and from where I sit, that's non-debatable. I would agree. However, when I'm looking at, you know, what our charge is in terms of trying to evaluate within the quality of the evidence that's available and somehow link that to quality of care, I think, you know, held to that standard, I think you're hearing the committee members, and I won't speak for every committee member, but myself, I'm hearing us say that that's a higher standard. Now, having said that, I don't know how you get to that higher standard until you start to catalog the information. So in terms of desirability, I would have to say yes, but in terms of meeting the criteria that are put in front of us, linking the quality of the documentation of cancer staging to quality of care, and is there a supporting body of evidence? If that's the criteria, then I think, you know, or at least my recommendation would still stand where it is. So
I think you've done an eloquent job of sort of raising the issue that we're facing here. And thank you. That's a great way to put it.
So having said that, I don't know if there is an option for us to make a recommendation that is desirable in the pursuit of being able to get after the greater good. I don't know how you get to one without the other.
Yeah,
I don't know how you get to that linkage without first obtaining that information, as the commenters are suggesting.
So, yes, it's definitely possible for you to make the recommendation for endorsement. If there's something that the measure developer can provide to strengthen the measure, in your opinion, you could let them know at this point.
Well, I think that, you know, the document provided is lengthy, but, you know, what we have to evaluate the measure is what's provided in the document. And if, you know, someone who was developing the document must have felt it was important enough to go into some of these nuances of the staging and the different types of staging and so forth that went into creating what went into the numerator and denominator of the metric. So I think we're really not looking to get into that granular, we're really looking to get some documentation, then I think the document needs to be more concrete that is actually what you're going to measure. But then my then follow-up question to you would be, is ideally here, you're right, we need to start somewhere. And secondly, we obviously want to try to leverage behavior in a direction which is going to be positive in terms of the ultimate improvement in quality goal. And I guess the question is, to what extent do you have a measure that it becomes more important to fill in the stage box, even though it may be a mishmash of what goes into the stage box, as opposed to sort of filling in with something that actually is going to be accurate and used in the way that you expect it to be used? And I guess that that's a little bit of the issue I'm struggling with. If you're like a busy clinician, okay, I know I'm going to get evaluated. I need to put something in that box. It's kind of like, I'm not sure I'm going to get back to this later. I'm just going to fill in my best guess at this point. That'll fulfill the metric. But is that the type of documentation you're trying to leverage?
So this is Jim Heyman again. I don't want someone just to fill in a box, you know, for the sake of filling it in. I mean, that's, you know, if they fill it in incorrectly, that's an error, right? But I think by, you know, making people think, wow, you know, this is an important piece of information, you know, I better try to stage the patient as accurately as I can. And, you know, I might need to actually, you know, look up something in the staging manual and fill it out properly, you know, and that information, like you said, you know, is going to, you know, be carried along with the patient over the whole course of their illness. You know, if we're not trying to, you know, send a message to people of what we think might potentially be important, you know, this seems like an important part of developing a care plan for a patient. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I've been involved in this process before. You know, I'm sure it's been changed over time. You know, from my opinion, and that's all this is that, you know, to rigidly adhere, you know, and not sort of, you know, what the requirements are for endorsement of a measure. I mean, it seems to me like it's a bit of a relative process, not an absolute process.
Well, I know the criteria that the NQF lay out to sort of evaluate the measure of those, clearly there's judgment involved, but it seems to be quite like explicit in the, and you know, that it, as much as I think the opinion of an experienced clinician is certainly no one to say that's not important, but again, the criteria used to evaluate the measures that, you know, that opinion is going to be viewed as kind of a lower level evidence to sort of support a direction. I think that, and as far as the your best guess at the stage, I think that the, you know, again, I keep coming back to this thing that you've got a measure that has no exclusions to it. And that so there's going to be, as described, again, we're responding to what's written down in terms of how you're constructing the numerator and denominator. With no exclusions, you could, you know, one might argue that I'm seeing someone for the first time, there's incomplete staging data, and in reality, what would be the type of behavior you'd want to leverage is that is a option to say, you know, staging information incomplete or something like that, so it would reflect the fact that, you know, I'm someone else is going to follow up on this person, I evaluated them. Other things are going to be done which, you know, are not going to be part of this initial evaluation, but that will not leverage the person to sort of just, you know, say, well, I kind of think it's stage 3 disease.
So this is Jim Heyman again. So, you know, all of the AJCC staging includes a TX, NX, MX, which means, you know, that it can't yet be assessed. So, I mean, that would be, you know, an appropriate stage, you know, to report if that's, you know, where the patient was in their evaluation.
Mm-hmm. This is Michael Hassett. Also, I think the stage, at least the measure as formulated, focuses on documentation within the first year to give the provider time to gather the information that would be needed to come up with their determination about stage.
This is Sam Tierney with the AMA. If I could just make another comment. I wonder if it's possible for NQF staff, if they haven't already, to share with the steering committee that exception that is noted in the evidence report. I know from colleagues who attended the recent care coordination steering committee, where obviously a lot of randomized control trials haven't been conducted, that they seem to conduct the review in two phases, looking at whether or not the evidence met the requirements for quantity, quality, and consistency, and if not, they look to see whether they felt that an exception applied. And I think for some of these measures, and even the one you're going to review next, you're not necessarily going to have clinical trial data that, you know, assesses patients with stage and patients who don't have a stage to try to determine their ultimate outcomes. I think that that's just going to be a situation where evidence is lacking, and so I guess I would say that it seems like the exception to NQF's policy and requirements would apply here, and perhaps the steering committee could benefit from that full information that's included in the report about when that exception is appropriate.
We'll be happy to share that with the committee. We have sent it out, actually, in the beginning, but we can send it out again.
Right, right. And the committee, you should have it in front of you. It's for, you want to make sure that in the case where you believe that there would not be evidence as the high-quality, randomized, controlled trials, that the measure is important enough and reliable enough to continue your review and still find it to be recommended for endorsement.
Could you explain what you mean by continue to review?
Well, we do have two must-pass criteria, and those are the evidence importance section and the second section, which is reliability and validity in the form of the measure. And if those two criteria are not met, then discussing feasibility and usability is not engaged in. Now, we're in initial discussions right now, and at the in-person meeting, this will be subject to a final vote. So it will be more critical as we get to the in-person meeting to make your decisions about the measure based on those two must-pass criteria. And then if the measure passes that criteria, then moving on to feasibility and usability.
Okay. Again, new to this process, but can I make a proposed recommendation?
Sure.
And could we say that it does not pass the criteria, but we could support the cataloging of this information?
That would be a possibility.
Well, I'm going to be so bold as to make that recommendation and get my fellow committee members to react to it.
Yeah. So I do think this distinction between a new measure and a maintenance measure is important, though, because I think the message also is that, you know, there may not, you know, for a lot of these measures, we wouldn't expect randomized clinical trials, but we would begin to see evidence that's documenting that these measures are associated with important patient outcomes. And as these measures are used, I think there should be a higher standard for what kind of evidence is presented for validity of these measures as measures of quality. So these are all maintenance measures that we're talking about. So I need some guidance in how much expectation I should have as a reviewer that we should start seeing something beyond face validity, which most of these measures have. I mean, nobody here can argue with the importance of these things, but the question really is whether or not they're associated with important outcomes. And as these measures have been out there for a while, it seems like we should start seeing some of that data in these reports or in these documents. And that's what I'm not seeing for really all of these measures that we're reviewing today.
Or I think, I mean, I would agree, and I would think that at a minimum, how they actually have contributed, say, to quality improvement.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's what we're not seeing. And so if this was a new measure, and we're going to talk about a new measure coming up, my standards are much lower, because we don't think there's data. But in this case, these have been used in large sample quality improvement or, you know, performance initiatives for 3 years now. And it seems like we should start seeing some of that data, or at least in the requirements that I'm looking at that's been given us by NQF, I'm expected to see some actual data from the use of these measures, which I'm not really seeing other than this very broad swipe at reliability and the face validity.
Okay. Well, in the interest of time, is there a quick summary of how we how the work group feels the sense of the measure on this one?
I got to make one last question, like, which I think is follow up to the very relevant comment that was just made. I mean, what is the expectation regarding these maintenance measures in terms of in terms of what the developer, you know, needs to deliver on and the time frame to do it.
In terms of in the interim between the first endorsement and
yeah.
this endorsement?
Okay. Yeah, in terms of it, if we're theoretically you've got something, well, we kind of have space validity.
Right.
We'll give it a go. We'll see how it goes. And it's with the implication that you're going to see some additional data at some point to say, oh, yeah, that this is making, you know, this is leading to improved outcome, for example. And I guess that
right.
that when you have these things which have been out there, and at least based on what, you know, we've been given a review, it seems that the main metric of validity is that a bunch of experts think it's important, but it's not like, you know, on the first rollout, that's sufficient in terms of validity. Once you've been working with a measure for a while, you would think at some point you would start to say, okay, we'll look to see how, you know, the people that did and didn't do it this way, and then, you know, what impact and outcome there is. And I guess that what's unclear is, well, is it the idea that, well, gee, that's going to take 10 years, and 3 years is too short a timeline to do that. Like, what is the expectation of the developer in terms of providing that additional validity data, you know, is synchronized with these reviews?
We do, as steering committees, do expect generally to see some interim data that supports the measure in the between the first endorsement and the maintenance review. So that is the expectation, and developers can indicate that on their forms or indicate, you know, why there is maybe not that that expectation is not realistic for us. So there is an expectation for data, but that can also be explained by the developer if it is not apparent in the measure.
This is Michael Hassett. The request for outcomes linkage to measurement over time, I think, is certainly highly desirable, but I think it's a particular challenge for cancer-related measures, given that the most common outcome in cancer of survival can be far off and difficult to assess, and there are really no great interim validated outcomes measures to connect with these process-based measures that we're talking about. It's a challenge that I think almost every cancer-related measure will face, whereas if one was looking at a measure of diabetes, there are better surrogate outcome measures such as hemoglobin A1C. The same could be said for vascular disease and surgery and 30-day mortality. But with cancer-related measures, it's quite difficult to come up with measures that are not very far off or confounded by decisions and other factors.
Well, thanks. We still have two measures to review. Can we do we have specific questions for the developer on this measure to address some of our concerns at this time?
And who did you need open?
I think the lines for the AMA PCPI folks are open.
Okay, and all those lines are still open.
Okay.
Angela, this is Sam Tierney again. I guess I just wanted to comment on the discussion that just took place. I'm not aware of any NQF guidance that the endorsement criteria for new measures versus maintenance measures is different.
There is no difference in answer to your question. There's no difference. However, there's an expectation in terms of the evidence provided.
I also
this is Lindsay from NQF. I think also you'll see on the measure submission form, we ask for evidence from current use on the performance gap and on disparities. I'm not sure that we specifically ask for it on the validity and reliability, to your point, Sam.
Yeah, and we do have information, just to clarify, related to the current use of the measures in terms of performance rates. I'm not aware, again, of any guidance related to a need for us to document as part of our testing projects or part of our reliability projects or even the testing guidance that NQF put out that the measure actually results in improved outcomes. As Dr. Hassett said, obviously that would be ideal, but conducting tests of those of that nature, I think, is extremely cost intensive, and actually, to my knowledge, in the medical literature, it's only been done on a few existing measures out there, and many of them are publicly reported at the hospital level. So I guess I just wanted to share that. It seems like there may be some, again, it seems like folks are maybe holding the maintenance measures to a higher standard. I'm not necessarily sure that that's provided for in the NQF criteria or guidance. And I think we do have data regarding the use of the measures, which certainly you would expect for measures that have been out there for some time. And so I think we've addressed that.
Okay, thank you. We still have on our discussion number 381, oncology treatment summary communication. And Jennifer Mallon, I have as a lead discussant for that. Is that correct? Are you on?
Sorry, I'm on mute again.
Oh, okay, sorry about that.
Let's see, I'm trying to see if I can find this. I didn't know that I was discussing that one.
Heidi Donovan, I'm sorry, Heidi Donovan.
Oh, good. I was going to say that was news to me.
Sorry about that. So if you could take us through it.
Sure. I think some of the same issues apply, you know, that we've been having these conversations about. I appreciate all the input from the sponsors of the measures, and, you know, I'll be rethinking some of my comments and rereading through things again. So I think the two things that stand out for me on this measure, and this is the measure of treatment summary communication for radiation oncology, is first, I was a little bit concerned about the ambiguity, perhaps, of some of the aspects of this measure. Now, at the time that I was reviewing this, I was not clear on what inter-rater reliability represented for these sponsors. And I just want to confirm again that inter-rater reliability for this measure does mean two independent raters go in, extract data from the chart that address the three different components of assessment for the numerator, the dose delivered, the relevant assessment of tolerance to progress towards the treatment goals, and subsequent care plans, because to me those seem somewhat ambiguous, and they do report that they have good reliability, but I just wanted to confirm that that is the process that was used. So that's one of my primary questions. And then the other one, just like in all these other measures, is that there really is not evidence that's provided for the importance and impact of this measure, other than from a clinical practice guideline that does not seem to have a systematic review of the literature. And so that was those were my two primary concerns for this one.
Thank you. Did you have an initial recommendation?
Well, I guess based on those two criteria, I felt like it didn't meet the criteria that we were asked to hold measures to, so I had a no.
Comments from the rest of the work group? Any comments on this one from the rest of the work group?
I think I mean, my main question with this one was, and there wasn't a lot of evidence provided about this, but I think this has been kind of a standard expectation for a long time, and I'm not sure that there's any variability on this measure.
Are there work group comments?
No, I thought it was largely a documentation measure. That is, I thought it was, you know, certainly potentially important as a component of kind of care coordination communication, which would be a priority, but it may be a necessary thing, but not a sufficient thing to indicate that. And I thought some of the evidence provided, I think, was kind of lowish or insufficient. And so I similarly thought it was it voted as a no for endorsement.
All right. Additional comments, or do we have a response from the developer on variability and evidence?
Sam, this is Jim Heyman. Can you speak to the question about the inter-rater reliability?
Yes.
And then I can address some of the other issues.
Okay, sure. So I can't remember the reviewer's name, and I apologize, but the way you described it is absolutely correct. However, I just wanted to mention that these chart abstractors, are going in and they're making sure that there is agreement between what they found in these charts. So you're absolutely correct. One abstractor goes in, and then the second abstractor goes in, and they basically compare their results and then come up with a rate of agreement.
Okay.
So that's your answer to your inter-rater reliability testing question.
So they would look for those three factors in the chart?
Yes, they're looking for the data elements in the chart.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
So this is Jim Heyman again. I maybe can speak to some of the other issues that were raised. While it may be true that there's a perception that this is done commonly in radiation oncology practices, in fact, I think that some of the data from I'm not remembering the project that was done with RAND and ASCO, found that rate, I want to say it was around 65%. So it's not as high as you might think it is. The other thing that it's worth looking at is what we're looking for in this treatment summary. So just to speak, I know there was a question about the dose is the dose, and that should be specified. Subsequent care plan really refers to follow-up. You know, were there any plans made for follow-up? And then how the patient tolerated the treatment and was the treatment completed, you know, gets to the second point. The measure is specified, also asked that this communication be timely within 1 month of completing treatment, and also that it be sent, not only that it just be, you know, put in the patient's chart in the radiation oncology department, but that it be sent to the physicians who are you know, involved in the care of the patient, and also to the patient themselves. And I think that, you know, if we really think care coordination is important, I don't know, you know, what's more important than providing this sort of, you know, communication to the patient, to their providers in a timely fashion. So I wouldn't say that it's potentially important. I would say that it's critically important and that it's absolutely necessary to provide at least this minimum information so that, you know, people are aware of what happened while the patient was, you know, undergoing their treatment. And I'm not, you know, sure that there are a lot of care coordination measures out there that, you know, necessarily have, again, high-level evidence to support them, but I think this is critically important.
Jim, how often do you make a decision and follow up on a patient that you're trying to make a radiation decision on just based on the treatment summary?
So are you asking me if I need to retreat someone?
Yeah, like if you're looking, you're going to make a treatment decision. Like,
I think it's a place to start.
A standalone piece of information, or would you always request additional information?
Well, I think it's a place to start. I mean, I don't think that the patient is going to want a copy of their treatment plan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a radiation oncologist, if I was going to retreat someone, you know, I would, you know, need that information. But, you know, certainly if I have a treatment summary, I know who to contact. I know at least some basic outline. I know what total dose they received. And, you know, that it's a starting point. But you know, I think that, you know, most, you know, other oncologists who aren't radiation oncologists would be, you know, very, I would think that they would want this information, to know this information about their patients who were treated. I don't know, Michael, if you wanted to comment on that.
So could I just interject? This is Jen Malin. So I just wanted to clarify, in the NICS study, actually, the indicator, the denominator, was actually the treatment summaries themselves, and the numerator was the percent of treatment summaries that included all three components, the dose per fraction, and the site. And so the fact that it was 50 or 60%, depending on the region, of treatment summaries didn't have all three pieces of information in them. So I think that was a separate issue. I think that having treatment summaries is really important. I guess my question just was, I was under the impression, and perhaps this is my misunderstanding, that in order to get reimbursement for delivering the radiation therapy, that these summaries were required.
I'm not aware of that being the case.
Okay.
So it's not a requirement?
Because I think that's sort of similar to an operative report, right? That's kind of a basic requirement.
The way that, you know, this is handled on a reimbursement basis is that typically, you know, we submit a charge for what's called a weekly management, and those, that code is the same for the first week and the last week. So there's no distinction made at the end of treatment.
Treatment, okay.
If you want to start reimbursing us for that.
Questions, additional questions from the work group on this one? All right. So we'll move on to Barrett's esophagus. This is our new measure that's being reviewed by the committee.
Yes, and this is Brian Loy. I think it's important for me to disclose before we get started that I am a member of the College of American Pathologists and have been so for many years, also a member of the American Society for Clinical Pathology. So unless that presents a problem, I'll proceed.
No problem.
Okay. In general, I'll keep my comments brief on the front end. I think the themes that we've heard on some of the other measures apply here. A, it's a new measure. My overall impression is that this would be desirable to catalog. I think it's an important step. So it would be much more desirable to have Barrett's esophagus documented versus not having it documented. However, I would say in holding to the exercise that we're asked to evaluate, I think three of the four committee members said no, it does not meet the criteria necessary for endorsement. So that's the bottom line. Having said that, I think a lot of that is driven by the fact that it's new, and many of the criteria that we were asked to evaluate were still yet to be determined. But again, I would emphasize that I think it's desirable to catalog. As I walked through it, some of my general impressions, and knowing that the college is on the phone that I might ask them to respond to, would be here's some of the comments that might help prepare the larger group as we think about meeting together in person. I was curious as to a couple of issues. One, the esophageal biopsy report under Section 2A1.1 says we need to know whether it's present, absent, or indefinite, but it really didn't get into grading, and I was curious as to why the college thought that the, you know, low versus high-grade dysplasia would not be important. Number two, I was hoping as I was walking through this document to better understand perhaps some of the confounders that I might understand. I was trying to link Barrett's esophagus to a quality outcome, meaning document it, ultimately either results in an endpoint of getting treatment or prevention of adenocarcinoma abated. So I know there's a lot that goes into that in terms of frequency of biopsy as well as the sampling technique. And then just as a finer point on the sampling, I was hoping that in here somewhere that I would have seen a mention of a verification of the biopsy site as being an important component of this. So all of that being said, I think that in general, there was some disagreement, but the high impact fell into the moderate category. I believe that the quantity of the evidence, there was two articles cited, one from 2001, which talked about the quality of, or it was a mention, the quality of care in Barrett's esophagus. But again, I was having a problem taking just that topic line and trying to say, yes, that that really nails it down in terms of how putting this down on paper and cataloging that information led to an improved outcome. And another number two, the Netherlands study from 2010, which talked about the standardized review of endoscopy and pathology reports. I wasn't clear on the measure developers, the intent of providing that article to the review committee, because I was asking myself the question of what was in that article that really elaborated on the performance gap. So I'd very much appreciate the colleges or the developers, the measure developers' impressions on that as well. So there were two articles which kind of forced me to put the quantity at moderate. And if I was missing some information, please let me know. And I believe that I've covered my summary points there.
Danielle, can you open the lines for actually all the lines, please?
Absolutely. One moment.
Thank you. Do we have a response from the do we have other work group comments on this measure?
No, lines are open.
In response from the developer of this measure?
This is Faye Schmansky with the College of American Pathologists. I'm trying to figure out where to start. I think there, so we've had a lot of trouble finding evidence of gaps in care, and we did have some evidence in this case. And the Netherlands study, though it was published after we developed the measure, provided some additional evidence of a gap in care. They did have they did find those information in there, and I'd have to go back into the article to find exactly where it is.
I'm having a very difficult time hearing you. Can you speak up?
Sure. Can you hear me now?
A little bit.
Is this any better?
Much better, thank you.
Yes.
So the Netherlands study had some information about the absence of this statement, and having that statement, again, is pretty critical just to deciding next steps in care in terms of frequency of biopsies, as was mentioned. Some of the other elements that were talked about, including in the measure, it was hard to do that in the context of the denominator and coding choices we had. it just made it, it was extreme, it would have been a very complicated measure to vote for. And so we were somewhat limited in what we could do.
If I could pause right there, this is Brian Loy, and I understand, or I think I understand, are you saying that the ICD-9 codes or the proposed ICD-10 codes do not make the distinction between high-grade and low-grade dysplasia?
The ICD-9 ones do not. The ICD-10 is going to complicate this, and I actually don't want to get into that right now because it's the ICD-10 coding for Barrett's is insufficient. We'll just put it that way. So
okay.
There's different issues there. But the current coding for Barrett's in ICD-9 does not distinguish between the grade. So, you know, asking to include that grade in the measure would only account for those cases where it was dysplasia was present, wouldn't affect the absent or dysplasia. So we weren't really allowed to use secondary codes to separate them.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how to better explain it than that, but just
it was
difficult to code in the first place, and then to code for all these variables would have been hard to do, if not impossible to do.
Okay. Any other questions for the developer? All right, thank you. And as Dr. Loy noted, this is a brand new measure.
May I ask a question? I'm sorry. Did you all have evidence? Did the college have evidence that said documentation of dysplasia resulted in earlier intervention and then additional information, which I think exists, that says early intervention potentially results in a better treatment outcome?
I think that information is in the actual guideline in the STEMP article, and I will go back and check on that.
That might be useful to articulate. Is it in the Alkman or the Kerber's article?
I think it's in the guideline itself, which is Sampliner. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
And is the guideline a? Are you talking about the American College of Gastroenterology guideline?
That was the guideline we used.
Okay, and is that guideline grounded in an evidence basis, or is that a consensus opinion?
I think in evidence. But again,
that would be useful, I think, for the broader group to have in making a determination, I would submit to you.
Okay.
So you could provide that. And I also wanted to remind everyone, it's a new measure. It is untested, but we did allow it in for consideration because it is in the federal program, the PQRS program, and it is only eligible for time-limited endorsement. So I just wanted to remind everyone of that.
So if it's my job to make a recommendation, it would be does not meet criterion, but is useful to catalog.
Okay. Other comments from the work group?
I thought since this was a time-limited measure and they would have the time to provide the additional information, it seemed like it would kind of meet the bar of being able to be included at this point and give them the time to develop the additional information on validity and reliability, et cetera.
That's correct. That is correct. Other comments from the committee?
And I'm sorry, this is Brian Loy again. For completion's sake, I would say I think it is important to include the contingencies that we described, meaning determining whether the guidelines that were being proposed as evidence are either evidence-based or consensus-based, I think is an important feature to know.
Okay. And, Faye, is that something you can provide to us offline or by email, rather?
Sure.
Okay. Any other considerations? Okay. So that brings us to the end of our discussion of all the measures, and at this time we have some time for public comment. If there are members of the public on the call that would like to provide additional comments, you may do so at this time.
And all lines are still open.
Any other? Okay, hearing none. Adila, do you want to tell us about next steps for the work group?
Sure. Our in-person meeting is in 2 weeks. If you haven't made any travel arrangements or anything like that, then please contact us and we'll get that set up as soon as we can. We'll also be providing the preliminary results right before the in-person meeting, and we'll be combining all four work groups' preliminary results so that you'll have it before the meeting in order to help you do your final voting. And Lindsay, if you're there and you have anything to add.
This is Lindsay. I don't have anything to add, just to thank you all for working overtime, and we really appreciate your efforts here.
Is there an opportunity for us to modify our preliminary reviews or just leave them as is with?
Absolutely.
Oh, go ahead, Lindsay.
I was just going to say, absolutely, if you want to modify your votes as a result of this conversation, you can go ahead and submit them. If you'll just make a comment on there so that we'll know which is your last version of voting, we'd really appreciate that.
Okay, so going into the same SurveyMonkey and...
Exactly.
Great. And when do you need those by?
If we could get them by Tuesday of next week, that would be really helpful. But if you need extra time, if you could just send us an email and let us know.
Okay. Any more questions about the next steps? Okay, well, hearing none, that'll be the end of our call, and please feel free to email us as well if you have any additional concerns or questions. With that, we'll go ahead and conclude the call, and thank you again for working overtime on this one.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. Thank you again for your participation. You may now disconnect.